Hello there.
Welcome to the Nerd Party.
You're listening to Trek FM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we look forward to seeing you there.
This is Steve Sansweet of Rancho Obi-Wan, and you're listening to the 602 Club.
Hi, this is Nick Anastasio, lead editor and writer on Maul Shadowlord, and you're listening to Aggressive Negotiations.
Well, hello and welcome to the 602 Club, coming at you from Shikari, because we've got a brand new crossover episode here with Aggressive Negotiations, which means that I have with me none other than venerable Jedi Master John Mills, because John, we've got more Star Wars to talk about.
How weird is it to have in quick succession, such quick succession, two crossover episodes to do because of two new releases from the Star Wars universe? It's between Maul Shadowlord and The Mandalorian and Grogu. Like, it's like going from a drought to a rainstorm. It's pretty amazing.
It's feast or famine. Right now we are feasting as Star Wars fans. Of course, you could find us all over social media, both shows. You can find us on X Twitter at the 602 Club or at The Jedi Masters. I can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/TrekFM or Facebook at facebook.com/TheNerdParty. You can also find us online at TheNerdParty.com or TFM.fan. And of course, we're on Instagram at the 602 Club TFM or at TheNerdParty. And so, John, Maul Shadowlord, it's a new Star Wars movie, and that just means we have so much to talk about. But I wanted to hit this right up front with you because it is something that I'm honestly already tired of hearing, which is the whole conversation of this being just like a long episode or seeming like there's a bunch of strung together episodes, because we know the question of whether this should be a season or a movie, that they had written a whole season of Mandalorian for it was season four. They had it tying in to all the things with Ahsoka and everything else they're doing. And because of the work stoppage, because of the labor disputes, they decided to prioritize The Mandalorian and make a film instead. And so they talked about this. They went back and they crafted a film, a story, whole cloth. They didn't go back and just string together some episodes. And so I just wanted to talk about that with you. Like, do you feel that while you're watching the movie? Do you feel like they made the right choice in taking The Mandalorian to the big screen?
I actually sidestepped the whole discussion because, to quote Peter Griffin from Family Guy, "Oh my God, who the hell cares?" At the end of the day, whatever process they used, it's just about whether you enjoyed the final product. That's it. Who cares? And to your point, I'm exhausted by a lot of the online stuff. I made a joke online that this is just warm up for next year during the 50th anniversary, where we're all going to argue about the special editions again and all of that type of stuff. It's going to come back. But I think that there is not a sense of this being a truncated season. And in terms of the, "Oh, this is four episodes put together" charge, I don't get that sense at all. This is definitely constructed differently than I'm used to with a Star Wars movie. There are clearer act breaks than we typically get with everything. But I don't get the sense that this is just a TV movie. I'm doing air quotes. This does feel like an entirely contained story that sits on its own. And then the ultimate tell is, if this is just four episodes strung together, I've seen this movie with family. somebody who's only seen the first two seasons of The Mandalorian, somebody who's seen all three seasons of The Mandalorian, and somebody who saw none of The Mandalorian. That's the child that wants nothing to do with her dad's Star Wars obsession. All three of them had the same reaction to the movie. So by my metric, you know, anecdotal, it's accessible to everybody. And something that's just four episodes strung together is not accessible. If I show, and this is where I'm going to really anger the nerds, if I show Serenity to a non-Firefly fan, they're going to just say, okay, because it is literally a series finale that just didn't get the chance to be aired. That is not the sense here. And that's just where I'll leave that.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great way to put it. And I think that actually really coincides exactly with what Jon Favreau has said about this film, is that one of the reasons they could have made this film where it was tying way more heavily into everything Star Wars and everything that they've been doing in the Mandoverse, right? And they said, look, we don't want people to feel like they had to have watched all three seasons of the Disney Plus show. We want people to be able to come into this film and feel like they understand the characters, they understand the motivations, and they can watch these characters go on an adventure, grow, and then be ready to jump into what's next.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's the thing that this movie actually does so well, because it is, I would say, incredibly accessible to those who know very little about Star Wars or The Mandalorian, but it's also incredibly fun then for those of us who know all of the things. And I mean, there are so many places in this movie where you can point out, oh, that's a Clone Wars design. Oh, that comes from this. Oh, that's from there. You know, like, there's so many. I mean, there's even references in this thing to stuff we've only really heard of in the books that they've had coming out, right? So, I mean, they're definitely going deep and trying to reward people who have seen everything. But at the same time, you want to make the kids happy as well that are just coming to see this movie. And that's the thing that, to me, my first showing, I'm in there, the IMAX screen is massive. I'm seeing it in Idaho because that's where we are at the time. And they have a really nice IMAX there in Boise. It just is one of those IMAXes that's huge, right? And man, the thing is packed and the kids are like loving it. And I could hear it. And then we saw it again, my wife, for her first time on Saturday. And same thing. We're in a smaller IMAX, but the thing is jam-packed. And dude, people are clapping and cheering. And you can hear the kids getting super excited or laughing at the Baby Yoda stuff. And it's just like that's the point of this film, is to take that generation that's been watching possibly The Mandalorian or The Clone Wars or stuff like that, right? And get them excited about Star Wars on the big screen.
Right.
And if you ask me, I think that's the thing that this movie is doing, is it is reintroducing Star Wars to a generation who, there are kids who haven't seen a Star Wars movie on the big screen.
I think that there is, first and foremost, you know what? I'm glad you had those experiences, specifically because this is where the anecdotal part of your movie-going experience can derail things sometimes. If I were to go by my anecdotal experiences of having seen the movie in the theater, none of my showings were sold out. Could be time of day. I took my youngest at 9:45 in the morning. I figured that had to have played into it. But I also know that the theater that I go to, because I live in Orlando, and Orlando, the big draw is going to be the AMC theaters at Disney Springs. That's going to draw people. The movie theater I go to is not that one. If I went simply by how many people attended the showings that I saw, I would say, oh my gosh, Star Wars is dead. This is the worst. Oh no, nobody is watching this film. So I'm actually very happy to hear that. I can tell you how the people at my showings reacted, but I can tell you, if we go simply by my anecdotal thing, but again, that's anecdotal, and I have to keep that context that 25 minutes down the road, is the happiest place on earth with a movie theater that has Dolby Vision attached to it. Okay. Like, obviously the theater I'm going to is going to be hurting a little bit. But at the same time, again, that brings me back full circle. I don't really care. It's just about whether you like the movie. That's all that matters. I don't care how it does in the box office. I don't see a dime of that. That doesn't matter to me. It's just about whether it works or not. And, you know, again, anecdotal, but it sounds like you and I are coming out of it saying, you know, for non-Star Wars fans or casual fans, this seems like it's working for them.
Yeah, and it was fun because, you know, we went and saw the film on Saturday with some more casual fans, and they, you know, they came out talking about it and liking it and laughing. I mean, I was sitting right next to them, and they're just kind of laughing at all the right places, right? You know, they're really seemingly into the film, and so, you know, I think the question I asked you is like, is this the right choice to bring it to the big screen, bring Mando and Grogu to the big screen? And to me, I think, in a sense, that it is the right choice because it. Look, when The Mandalorian came out, it was the thing that kind of galvanized fans back into Star Wars after the sequel trilogy. It was the thing that people rallied around, right? But it also, again, this is the Star Wars that many kids grew up with, right? Mm-hmm. You know, those seven-year-olds, again, may have never seen a Star Wars movie on the big screen. But they grew up watching Mando and Grogu on Disney Plus, and they love them. And so to give them that on the big screen, I think, is the right choice.
I mean, the thing is that what people need to keep in mind as context as well is it feels like we're drifting back toward movie going again. I hope we are. Indications are. I've been going to more movies than I have in years because my kids are going to movies. Chip off the old block, I guess. And I can tell you that I think that it would be so interesting to find a way to go to the branching timeline where 2020, and you know what I'm talking about, didn't happen. What does that landscape look like? Did the momentum of that streaming series carry them to a movie sooner in the cycle? Because I think that was an inevitability to it. And for people that are complaining about how long, quote unquote, it took the movie to get there. Yeah, it's a weird landscape right now, man. And people are still figuring out how to operate inside of it. I think it's the right move just from the context of, and this is going to be a weird way to phrase it, it's a low-risk movie. If the movie is a misfire, you didn't spend as much on it as you do on a typical Marvel movie type of thing. You didn't spend $600 million on this. You didn't spend $750 million on this. You spent what is considered a modest amount nowadays. The thing has very good chances of breaking even at a minimum. That's good. That's healthy. If anything, I hope that it's the right move because it readjusts expectations and they say, you know what? We can make a movie for about $200 million, promote it smartly, make our money back, keep people interested in things, and it's a good movie? Cool. Wins across the board. We're not trying to change the landscape. We're not trying to make a once-in-a-lifetime generational event. You can't predict those things. They come out of nowhere. So this feels like a very smart play. This is almost like watching a team play Moneyball in baseball, where you've got the things aligned and it's like, you know what? Maybe I'll go to the World Series. Anybody could. But at the very least, I can make the playoffs with this. And that's good enough because that gives me my puncher's chance. So again, I hate thinking of it from the business perspective, but additionally, why would you not lean into Baby Yoda? I know it's Grogu, but Baby Yoda was a cultural phenomenon. Bringing out a movie with him in it is a no-brainer if you're trying to come back to the big screen. Hey, remember this really cute thing you loved that kids love too? Hey, you know it's family-friendly. We're going to have the cute puppet, and there you go. So, I mean, that's a long-winded way of agreeing with you, but I think you get what I'm getting at there.
No, I mean, I think you're right. You know, look, Lucasfilm has had a really rough track record recently with Star Wars films, right? And even just the fact of even getting them made, you know, things get announced and they aren't getting made. And so, you know, the idea that you could then lean into something with two guys who are getting stuff done at Lucasfilm, right? And ask them to produce a film for you that people can hopefully get excited about and enjoy seeing at the theater to remind people that Star Wars on the big screen isn't dead, right? Mm-hmm. And I got to ask you about this, and it'll kind of lead us into the first other topic to talk about that goes along with the plot. But I wanted to phrase this before we even got to that part of the conversation. I keep hearing that this has a threadbare plot, that this barely has a plot. And I wanted to ask you about that because, you know, as we've been doing the rewatch for Mando Season 3, we are going to finish that, folks. Don't worry. That we promised to finish the season. And it'll be fun because we can kind of talk about this in light of, you know, and all that stuff. I think that'll be great. But do you feel like that when you're watching the movie? Do you just feel like that it has this shoestring plot, or did you feel like it had the right amount of plot for the type of film that it's trying to be?
That's the key right there. That's the right way to phrase it. The type of film it's trying to be. I made a joke with somebody that this is action film, the movie, but that's what but at the same time, it has a surprising depth to it. And it's, I think at a surface read, you don't necessarily get it. It's understood in retrospect. Because I remember coming out of the showing I watched first night with IMAX, was I sat with it and I was like, I know I enjoyed this. I know I had a good time with it. But my initial thought was, but it's not as deep as I'm used to for Star Wars. Okay. But then as I sort of mused on it, I was like, oh, well, okay, there, you know, here's this scene. That's actually pretty deep. Here's this conversation. That's actually pretty deep. The movie's not going to escape without some dings from me. There are definitely some process errors. There are definitely some script level errors I would have addressed to make it a little bit cleaner and a little bit more direct. I think what people react to, let me ask this question to you. Do you think people are reacting to that this is our first Star Wars movie without an Imperial / First Order level villain? This is, if anything, the stakes are, they get the Imperial stuff out of the way right off. They're like, we're just going to, fine. Yes, you want Empire? Here's Empire. There. The stormtroopers are there. All that stuff you recognize is there. We're going to move on and we're going to talk about something else now. And it's not what you're used to seeing as the stakes of a Star Wars movie. Do you think that's what people are reacting to after years of complaining that that's what they wanted?
Yeah, I mean, the problem is this is not threat level midnight, you know, and so I think, in all honesty, you know, to me, this plays and I, somebody on Twitter said this, so I give them credit, but that this is basically like the Ant-Man. What Ant-Man is, the MCU, Mando and Grogu is to the Star Wars franchise as films.
That's fair.
And I really agree with that because in many ways, this to me kind of felt like, you know, it's kind of like an action adventure movie. It's, you know, Indiana Jones-ish. It's got a little bit of James Bond into it, you know, and it clearly is just an action adventure film. Like, that's what it is. But I would argue that, yes, the stakes are smaller, but the story, if you ask me, is more personal in many ways than we've had in a while. And that's because this is really tying in, and this is where I think that if you've watched The Mandalorian as a series, it makes a lot more sense and it brings a lot of those themes to light. Because, you know, Mando's new job is an old job that he's had, but it's also new in the sense that he's still working basically as a bounty hunter or a secret agent, whatever you want to say, right? And yet he's doing it exclusively for the New Republic. He's hunting down their most wanted, right? They've got their Deca Sabacc Imperial warlords that they're trying to bring in, and, you know, their war on terror. And what I love about this, though, is that, like you and I have been doing, we're wrapping up Mando Season 3 on Aggressive Negotiations, and this makes perfect sense in light of where the series has taken that character, right? Din started out as the bounty hunter who didn't care who he was taking in or, you know, what their story was. Mm-hmm. And now we see him being somebody who's willing to hunt down exclusively the true threats of the galaxy, right? The imperial threat that still exists. And why is that the case? Because he's come face to face with Moff Gideon and seen exactly what the Empire is capable of still and what they would long to do if they could get back into power. And that's the last thing he wants, especially in light of the fact that he's now a dad. And all of that is predicated on everything that we've seen this character grow towards. And that's the thing that I kind of love about the plot, is that it's moving forward the story for these two main characters. And what we're going to do in this whole film, yes, it's smaller, but it's about them and their growth. It's not really about the all-expanding universe of Star Wars. It's about how the adventures that these characters are going are helping them grow one step after another. And this is another stepping stone in their growth. And it starts immediately in this film with us realizing that Mando's job is new and old at the same time.
Well, the element of child endangerment remains, that's for sure. Because, you know, that's a going thread with the Mandalorian. But I think that there is a, like, the thing that works well is the fact that this is about a personal journey. And I think it is, I'll cop to it. It was disorienting to me because there wasn't a big super weapon we were trying to stop. There wasn't a resurrected emperor we were trying to stop. There wasn't the Death Star plans we were trying to get. There was, like, there, if anything, in its bones, it reminded me a bit of Solo in the sense that at the end he says, oh, I don't work for the New Republic. And, you know, Sigourney Weaver's character, you know, says, sure you don't. You know, like, there's that whole thing of, like, it's when he says to Kira in Solo, I'm not the good guy. And she goes, yes, you are. And Mando is still denying that he's part of the New Republic.
Yeah.
And she's like, sure, okay, whatever. Like, that's growth in and of itself, even within the structure of the film itself. I think the one thing that winds up being difficult for audiences is the fact that your main character, you can't see his face through the majority of the film. And we as human beings very much look for visual cues for how to feel and how to react to things. I would ask you, should they have taken the helmet off more than once, even if he's alone, so that we could at least get more face time with the Mandalorian throughout the course of the film? Do you think that would have been something that would have been wiser to do?
Yeah. That, I mean, it is an interesting question, and maybe it is just me, but I think it works for me, and partially to me, the job that all three of them do in bringing this character to life works in a way where, just like almost like a droid, where I can read the emotion, I could do the same thing with Mando. And I think that's the beauty of Star Wars, is it's taught us to be able to layer into the character the emotion that they should be having, just from movement, just from a tone of voice, just from, you know, and so for me, you know, it works. I don't really have an issue with it. I don't know if you feel the same way, but you know, even just with the series itself, you know, the helmet comes off very seldomly in that show, and it never hurt my enjoyment of the series personally.
I'm not coming down on either side. I'm more, I guess, more traditional in the sense that I would have given like one more scene where his helmet's off and he's either calling somebody or recording a captain's log sort of thing, where his helmet's off and he has a scene where he reveals his deepest fears about raising Grogu or something like that. I think that would have been a good scene to have. But again, that's me rewriting the movie. And it's like, I'm not in that business. That's just sort of throwing it out there as maybe there was room for a scene like that. But what do I know? Because again, those three people who saw the movie with me, they reacted fine. They didn't have an issue with it. So I can go pound sand. That's a personal taste thing. And I'm like, okay, well, it didn't matter to them. Doesn't matter to me then. That's fine.
Yeah, you know, and I think that's the thing, too, that I have to keep coming back to, right? That if we want Star Wars to survive, we have to find a way to do the thing that another Star franchise isn't doing very well, which is to bring in new fans. Mm-hmm. And again, this is the thing that kids grew up with. You know, the 7-year-olds, this is their Star Wars.
Yes.
And so allowing them to experience that Star Wars on the big screen, I think, is important for them to say, oh, wow, this can exist at the movie theater.
This is special.
Exactly. And I think, you know, we've talked about this many times, and I'm guilty of it, right? Of being super precious with the Star Wars. You know?
Yeah.
And I think that's kind of the thing, too. If we learned anything from George Lucas, it should be, don't be precious with this thing. It's made for kids. It's meant for kids. And
or the kid inside.
Exactly.
Or the kid inside.
100%. And which is one of the reasons I think both you and I have continued to respond to it, because we don't need it to be the deepest, darkest thing ever, right? And I'm glad I got Andor. I love Andor, but it's like, I don't need all my Star Wars to be that. I think that's the beauty of what we're kind of seeing recently. We just had Maul come out. That's a completely different type of Star Wars than this, right?
Yes.
You know, it's darker and grittier in many ways, a lot like Andor, with the themes it's playing with, the violence you get, the type of stuff that we're dealing with emotionally with the characters just the idea of like talking about revenge all the time anyway, you know? And then, you know, you get this and it's a movie. And I think this is the thing that I came away from this film. And this film is Lucasian through and through. And the reason that is because this is a movie that brings us back to George Lucas's first and foremost theme in Star Wars. It's fatherhood and mentorship. And Din telling Grogu that the old protect the young and the young protect the old. This is the way. And in fact, this movie actually even connects all the way back. My wife and I, before she went and saw the film, we got a chance to watch the Clone Wars movie together. And it was amazing how Dave's first work with George in that film, where Anakin is learning that to be a teacher for Ahsoka is a privilege, to pass on what he's learned, right? Obi-Wan's trying to get him to understand, no, it's a privilege to pass on what you've learned to the next generation. And that's exactly what Din has been doing this whole movie, right? And the whole series, right? He's slowly teaching Grogu how to survive in this big universe. In fact, you know, as we've been talking about season 3 on Aggressive Negotiations, it's one of the things we're watching him do, right? He's explaining things to Grogu about how things work in a starship and figuring out where you are and all this stuff. And it's like, he knows that Grogu is going to outlive him long after he's gone. And so what does he need to do as a good father and a good mentor to this kid? he needs to be able to teach him to survive on his own. And this movie, again, is all about actually what it means to be a good father as opposed to all the crappy fathers we've seen in Star Wars. You know, and I absolutely adore that it is celebrating, you know, right before we hit Father's Day, it is celebrating what it means to be a good dad, whether you're a biological dad or an adoptive dad.
I can tell you that what really resonated and hit differently was the moment on the sequence on Nau Hutta, where Grogu is caring for him. The kid who has never watched a moment of The Mandalorian was crying openly in the theater. And, you know, to borrow her words, she said, "I knew they weren't going to kill him, but still it really affected me." And I'm sitting there with my kid, and my kid is reacting that way. And, you know, of course, my follow-up comment was, "So remember, if something happens to me, you got to help out," right? That's the message of that scene, right?
Which, likely you live in Florida, so that's easy to build.
Oh, well, trust me, the insect scene, nobody in Florida blinked at that one. The insect is like, yeah, he was laying there for like 2 seconds. What do you expect?
Yep, exactly.
He's lucky he didn't have a snake in his armor. Please, whatever. A gator didn't eat him. But I think that it is emotionally resonant what it does. Now, I think that what's beautiful as well, and a friend of ours, mutual of ours, Yancey, pointed this out, that what's interesting about the film is it is called The Mandalorian and Grogu. And The Mandalorian, at one point, it does flip and it becomes Grogu's story. Grogu is demonstrating that he's grown, that he's figured out how to survive, that he's learned all the lessons from his dad. And that's one of the things where I think it's very subtle. And sometimes I think audiences, or rather, not all audiences, but specific subsets of audiences wind up subconsciously pushing back because they want what the message is told to them instead of shown. And I think that this film does a very good job of showing what it's trying to say. Again, there are things that I think this film could have done better. But when it comes to that moment in specific, it did it very well. I got it. And it had a very emotional moment. I mean, for me, when he sees the Anzellan's ship going off and he thinks Grogu is on it and he just says, "Goodbye, kid," while he's running through like Rambo and knocking droids off to buy them time. And the mute, like, you know, Goranson's score is just fantastic. And really feeling that emotional swell. And then when he falls and Grogu shows up to save him, and then we have that whole sequence with him. Like, it's a movie that kind of blows my mind in that respect, because there isn't a single human face on the screen and it tells its own little story without any dialogue until Grogu meets Gatorri. And that's amazing. How many summer movies do you see where they take that amount of time and have only visuals and music? That, if you want to use the term Lucasian, that's a George Lucas thing. It's a visual medium, folks. And I think that specific moment was beautiful because of that.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, look, this movie, what it is all about is a father teaching his son how to learn to take responsibility in the world in which he lives and how to do all the things he needs to do to survive. You know, he's, you know, again, like, we've seen very few good fathers in Star Wars. Bail Organa, one of them. But other than that, can't really think of any other good fathers. And so, you know, Din, you know, it's hard to see your kid grow up, right? There's a point, part of you that, and we even see that, right, at the beginning of the film where Din is on the Razor Crest and he's like, "Don't touch any of the buttons. Sit down and be quiet," basically, you know? And by the end of the film, he's realizing, no, I need to be able to teach him the things that are going to actually help him be the things that can go away from me. It's the same. And, you know, I know you've experienced this with a couple of your kids, right? And I've seen other people do it. It's like when you're teaching your kid how to drive, you're doing the thing that's going to help them take that you away from them, like them away from you, you know?
Trust me. Din Djarin did a better, he handled that better than I did. So I'll come clean on that one.
But look, I think Din in the movie, he's realizing that even though it is hard to see his son growing up, he needs to be challenged. He needs to let go a little bit. He needs to train Grogu even more. And I think, you know, another Lucasian aspect of this film, especially when in the aspect of fatherhood, is really, you can, George always said, you could go through, pick up a copy somewhere of George Lucas interviews, read those original interviews. George always talked about that Star Wars is the antidote to the cynicism of the films of the 70s, the culture of the 70s,
oh, yes.
Right?
Oh, very clearly. Very clearly.
And so the whole point of Star Wars then was to inspire the next generation through myths and legend-like storytelling to reinforce good morals and messages and meanings to kids through an entertaining story. And in the end, The Mandalorian and Grogu is the antidote to so much of the cynicism that has just continued to creep back into our society. And because it's celebrating what it means to be a good man, what it means to be a good father, and what it means to train up a child in the way they should go so when they're old, they don't depart from it. That's what is happening in this film, and I think that's what so many people are kind of missing about the beauty of this movie, because they're not paying attention to the small, again, you mentioned it. You're not used to Star Wars telling a completely character-driven story that is so tied to only two characters, and yet that's what this one is doing, and I think it's doing it superbly because, no, we're not trying to just have the characters stay in a box. This movie is pushing the our two main characters forward, and Din is the first one that we've just been talking about.
Well, I think what's also interesting is having Rada be a relatable figure talking about that very connection. You know, I'm not my father. My father was a bad person. I don't want to be like him. But telling it in such a way that, I mean, I really want to break this down from this perspective, that so much of this movie is just bonkers. It's insane. You have a big death match. That's the chess game on the Falcon.
Yeah, the Djarin come to life.
You have Grogu on Nal Hutta, even discovering that beautiful grove. And I said this to one of my kids. You have this moment where Grogu, you know, Mando is dying. Grogu's trying to care for him. He's alone on this world. He's very tiny. And he walks out into this grove one day. We see him later meditating in it. And there's almost this lesson that even in the big, scary world, there are places of beauty and rest. And he comes out on this beautiful grove that has beautiful flowers and a log that he can sit on and a place of peace. So to your point, baked into this very thing is all of that type of stuff. Again, there are process errors here. There are things that don't quite work as well as they could. But those little moments are things that you can take out of the film that do capture that original spirit. And additionally, and I know I'm going off on a little bit of a tangent, but because thinking of Rada makes me think of this. If you took a time machine and you went back to me in 1983, and you said, you like that Jabba the Hutt guy, right? And I'd be like, oh, yeah, that's really cool. How would you like to see three of them in a match to the death wrestling over a pit that has a giant snake over it? I'd be like, get out. No. Really? Like, that aspect of the movie as well of the feeling of being a kid playing in your toy chest. You know, it was one of the things that with Book of Boba Fett, especially on the rewatch, that made me like it overall, was seeing somebody riding a rancor through the streets of a Tatooine town while a gunfight's going on. Is, you know, that's like, hey, 10-year-old you. You thought this up, didn't you? I'm like, well, yeah, I kind of did. That's really cool. Sorry. But that I think plugs into the whole thing about like that why it can work on those levels.
Yeah, no, I really agree with you on that. And you know, I think I would say another criticism I've heard is that, you know, Grogu doesn't really have a lot of growth. And I think Grogu's growth in this movie is they actually do let the character grow. He is coming into his own, right? He actually has his own adventure. He has to take on the responsibility of saving his dad all by himself, you know?
Mm-hmm.
We even see from the beginning of the film that he's more a part of Mando's plans, especially, you know, when we see them rescuing Rata, right? There's things that Grogu can do now that, of course, Mando could never do because he's not that small. He's being taught how to, you know, go into battle and be ready for it. You know, he's being asked by his dad his opinion on things. His dad is helping teaching him decision making. That's what that whole discussion about is like, do we run or do we fight? You know, and then in the end, the beauty of Mando teaching him how to fly, like he's taking responsibility and realizing, I actually made a mistake earlier when I didn't show him how all this worked, because if that had happened, it would have been easier to get away, you know, and at the same time, it's also that scary thing because you're teaching your kid the very thing that they're going to know how to now be away from you. They're going to be more free to be away from you because they have the skills to survive. And I think that was the real beauty of that whole sequence, you know. And the other thing I was thinking is just like that whole part where he's just sitting there and meditating, it let you know that his time with Luke.
Yeah, it made an impact.
He learned a lot.
Yeah.
We can see all that he learned with the ways that he's using the Force now. Again, he's also grown in that aspect of his ability to control the Force and use the Force. And that, again, it's like, people are saying like, oh, these characters don't really grow. It's like, no, this movie took literally everything that happened in the first three seasons of Mando and then allowed the characters to utilize all of them and to move forward. And on top of that, all of that, he's very close to almost talking. Like, there are moments where he almost says certain words. And it's like, so we can actually see that the character is progressing.
Well, there's also the entire thing of doing it in a self-contained way. You have to tell it in a chunk that, again, the casuals and the people who never watched it can get what's going on. And Grogu has a definite arc through this film. Is it a huge arc? Is it Luke suddenly realizing he's the son of Anakin Skywalker and he has a lightsaber now, which he never uses? And he blows up the Death Star? No. Again, it's a smaller stakes sort of movie. It's a very personal stakes sort of movie. While at the same time, if you really want to do it, if you really want to read more into it, you have an aspect from Lucas's own thing that he wanted to explore in his sequel trilogy about the crime syndicates and the Republic having trouble controlling them and working with them and having to take action against them. Like, that carries over. I see that as a very clear sort of, okay, well, we didn't get to do Lucas's sequel trilogy over here, so we're going to start doing aspects of it here. I see that with Maul Shadow Lord. I see that with this idea that the Republic isn't fighting the Empire. It's trying to tame the galaxy, and it's trying to get those sorts of things aligned. You have the Hutts, you have the crime syndicates that they're trying to deal with, which again, echo of Solo, the crime syndicates. It's saying, like, I think that this movie is important in terms of Star Wars lore, on-screen lore, because it's trying to say there are other enemies we're allowed to have. It doesn't just need to be the next Moff with a super weapon or a cloning technology or anything like that. It's okay to have a different type of villain.
Well, and I think there's a beauty in that too, and I'm so glad that you mentioned it, because that's another theme that I actually picked up in the film. And it's small, but it's totally there, which is that, you know, there's the whole point that Colonel Ward makes that they have been cultivating this relationship with the Hutts for a long time, New Republic security. And yet, it's like the lesson is a scorpion is always going to be a scorpion.
Yeah.
And that's the point. And so that lesson of like, who do we trust and who are we going to work with and why? I mean, you know, that's a galaxy spanning question. That's a real world question that, you know, we've been dealing with for thousands of years as human beings, right? You know, and I think the lesson kind of becomes that when somebody shows you who they are, believe it, right? And we have that whole moment where they're walking into Nau Hutta the first time, and Din is telling Grogu, the Hutts have been a part of the crime syndicates for thousands of years. And so when they show you who you are, who they are, believe it, right? And so the fact that the New Republic is trying to cultivate these relationships to suss out the Imperials, it's like, well, you know, you're using one scorpion to try and bite another scorpion, but you're still going to end up bit by somebody. And here, you know, we just get lucky in the story in the sense that Mando can kind of see through the BS and allows them to kind of navigate around it. And so I just think, you know, I love that you bring that up, because again, that's another wonderful little theme in the film. And it's like, if you're not paying attention, you're probably going to miss it, but it's 100% there. And I think it's, again, it's more of one of those things is, and you put this so beautifully, they're just showing so many things and in hoping that you're a smart enough audience to be able to pick it up.
Well, I think that what's great is that it's not so much about hoping you're a smart enough audience. It's about giving you enough entertainment that if you want to sit there and dig at it, you can. Or if you just want to watch the interesting explosions and everything, you can. Like that's where I'll give the movie a lot of credit, is that you can look at this just as eye candy.
Mm-hmm.
And you can look at it as, oh, well, look, there's three Hutts wrestling to the death while the Mandalorian is in a death match with another guy. Well, like, they have three fights to the death going on, and you have three different ways to resolve it. And it's like up to and including Grogu taming the beast basically with love. He has a villain coming to him, and his solution is just to, hey, we're friends, right? And like talk him down and like have a moment of peace in the middle of all of this stuff going on, which is interesting in and of itself. You have three situations and three different ways of dealing with it. But at the end of it, you know, we're sitting here, we're talking about this deeper stuff because that's how we're wired.
Yeah.
We're going toward that part of it. But if I want to turn off my brain and just watch a bunch of cool action sequences, I can.
Agreed. Yeah.
And it works that way too. It's just a ton of fun. And I really like in that aspect, turning it on its head and saying, good grief, looking at the fact that this is all so wild. And there are times where whether it's Pedro Pascal, Lateef Crowder, or Brendan Wayne, they're the only human there. Like this is such an escalation of the idea of how much do I need that's real? How much do I not? And that also speaks into, now James Cameron, of course, has heaped all of the praise and all of the attention with Avatar. Rightly so. I think Avatar is a great achievement. I'm not taking anything away from the Avatar films. But here's another movie where I'm looking at things and it's like, this, that the only real thing there is a guy in a Mandalorian suit spinning around, swinging at stuff.
Yeah.
Cool. I mean, it's basically at certain points, it's basically an animated movie. And it's like, but I don't sit there and say, oh, well, that's Minions. I look at it. I don't even think about it being animated. I have droids walking through now Hutta while a puppet's looking at them.
Yeah.
And not once do I go, oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Like, I have to think about that in retrospect. I'm like, man, there's nothing real there. That's wild. And the audience signs up for it and goes along with it to the point where they're cheering and clapping. Like, that's wild. It's such an abstract moment.
Well, and I think you mentioning all that stuff, you know, I like the creatures and the locations in this film are just, to me, you know, it's so well done. I love all of the uses of every single type of technology to bring these creatures together, from CGI to stop motion to puppetry. Everything that they can utilize under the sun in filmmaking, they're utilizing this movie. And I love the way it all works together, because that's the way George did it, right? You know, like in the original trilogy, yes, even in the prequel trilogy, you know, all of this stuff. You know, I love the fact that we're seeing now Hutta in live action. You know, we're getting things that have only been mentioned in books, like the droid Gotra, you know, which was in the book Tarkin, and then in the book Most Wanted. We're seeing dragon snakes and live action Jarek monsters, and a new planet like Shikari, which is like this wonderful mixture of like Brooklyn and Gotham and Blade Runner 2049 all together.
Can I just say really quick, one of the most beautiful things that I loved, I have seen it more than once, but even in the first showing, that I absolutely loved, that was such a testament to how far the thinking has gone with CG and backgrounds and stuff like that, is on Shikari, the city, there's stuff in the background where there's, you know, stuff that's light, it's lit up at night, and you see a bunch of insects floating around the lights, which is a detail that would not have been thought of 10, 20, 30 years ago. And to me, that shows such a level of thought and care that's put into it, because it sells the environment so much. And looking at Shikari, I'm going to go out on a limb. Don't come for me here. But there are aspects of it where I look at it and I say, I kind of wish Coruscant looked like this in the prequels, honestly. Like when they went down to the lower levels.
I agree.
I would have liked this more, because that set was a little bit lacking in episode two. So I kind of would have liked this more. But hey, you know, I'm just saying. I think even Lucas himself would admit, it's like, well, this is, you know, that's what we could do in 2002.
You know what this actually reminds me of is, you remember the planet and the Obi-Wan Kenobi show? This is what they were going for.
Thought the same thing.
But they couldn't get.
Yes, I thought the same thing, and it made me mad all over again, because I'm like,
same.
You could have done this. COVID didn't mean anything. You could have layered people on. You could have made this happen.
That's exactly what they could have done.
This is not fair that I had to wait this long to see this. Yes.
Yep. So frustrating. No, it's wonderful. I wanted to talk to you a lot. I mean, we got to talk about the fun friends that we get in this show. And Rada the Hutt being back, my wife turned to me because, you know, she'd seen the trailers and stuff, but she doesn't keep up with it like you and I do. So she didn't realize, and we had just watched the Clone Wars movie. So when he comes on the screen, the first time where they talk about him and they show a little picture, she looked at me and was like, giving me the like, is that what I think it is? And I was like, uh-huh. And she just ate it up. And man, I loved, like we talked about earlier, that the fact that they utilize this character as a juxtaposition, you know, his growing up versus what Grogu's experiencing, right? And that, you know, he has had to make the decision to not want to be like his father, whereas he keeps encouraging Grogu to basically be like his father. And Jeremy Allen White, I thought, did a fantastic job with the voice. I love the character. I thought the design work was phenomenal with him. And I'm like, I want more of this character. I hope that he, like, can you imagine him getting to see Ahsoka and meet Ahsoka again?
That would be super cool. I think that the, I agree with you about Rada. It leads to one of my process errors with the script and the film as a whole, in that I think that you could have compressed Mando's first meeting with him into his second meeting so that it was one scene of dialogue as opposed to two separate ones separated by so much. But with Rada, the thing that pulled the rug out from underneath my feet was that he wound up joining the New Republic at the end. I'm like, oh, I want to see that show. That's interesting to me. But also, my 10-year-old has absolutely no clue. Not no clue. She's seen the Clone Wars, all of it. But she doesn't really remember Rada. Rada only, you know, pops up in that one instance. Yeah. And when Rada came up on screen as the baby hologram, I heard this 10-year-old go, oh, he's so cute. He's as cute as Baby Yoda. I was like, that was slick, man. That was really slick.
A little stinky.
Yeah, a little stinky up on screen. But I think maybe what some fans might be reacting to, let me get your thought on this, what some fans might be reacting to and something that fills me with glee is there is an aspect of this movie that feels like Dave Filoni flexing and saying, I dare you to ignore the animated series from here on out. I dare you not to watch those things anymore. We got Zeb. We've got Rada. We've got so many things from the animated series worked in to this that it's just like, it's almost like he's defiantly saying, you have to watch them. You can't ignore them anymore, guys. They are legit story points that tie into this thing. Whereas if you were to go back to the first batch of movies that we got from the Disney era, they didn't necessarily want to acknowledge the prequels or the animated series. It was sort of, oh, that's a separate thing. We're not going to really acknowledge them. I found it refreshing that it treated these elements as, oh, no. This is all part of it.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I'm so glad you said that, because I absolutely think that's true. And this is the beauty that, they talked about, and I've, watched a little bit of Dave and John talking, and John specifically, we weren't going to tie in too heavily, but, we're going to use things that have been done. We're going to make them main characters, though. Rada the Hutt, he's going to be a main character. Zeb, he's a main character here. It's not just a cameo. He's Mando's partner in the film. Yeah. Like, he is the straight man. Well, maybe not the straight man, but, he's an actual character who's a pivotal part of the story in the relationship that Mando has with the New Republic. And I really loved that we got to see that character because, our whole experience with him in Rebels was such a wonderful experience. And so to kind of see him want to continue that fight and be part of, the rebellion ended, but making sure that all that he had fought for, exactly what Colonel Ward says, we're trying to prevent another war. That's what we're doing here. And that makes sense to see Zeb want to be a part of that. And, if anything, I just wish we could have gotten even more of him because it's wonderful to have him brought to live action. I mean, I know he's still a CG character, but I thought they did a fantastic job with the look and the feel of him as a character. And Steve Bloom, of course, being back to voice him, it's like the transition is seamless.
Absolutely seamless. You know how I feel about Zeb. More Zeb all the time. I'm happy with it. Now, you mentioned, the CG. And I think that Zeb is fully realized, beautiful. I think that Rada's fully realized and beautiful. You mentioned earlier the blend of all of the different effects. I'm going to ask the difficult question here. Do you think that all of the effects were as successful as they should have been for Star Wars' first big screen outing in this long? I know my opinion on it. I'm curious as to your opinion on it.
I will say, in all honesty, I did not have any moments that so completely pulled me out of the film that it ruined the experience for me. And I think that's important. I think the effects were mostly consistent, which is exactly what you need in a film, right? You need to pick a consistency level and just stay at that. And I think that they did that for the most part. I think here and there, there's a couple little moments, you know, maybe the chase sequence on the beach, you know, or even, you know, I've seen the movie four times now. So like flying through Shikari, you know, is it perfect? I don't know. But it felt like to me that they edited around most of what could be considered kind of like a, you know, not the world's best CGI ever. I really, you know me, I'm not afraid to criticize what I think to be bad CGI, but really for the most part in this film, it felt consistent enough that it didn't bother me if there was a quick moment of not consistency, if that makes sense.
Oh, not bother. There were definitely things, though, that stuck out to me. There was one shot in particular where the twins are in their lair, and it looked like a video game cutscene. That got under my skin for whatever reason. When he blows up the tunnel, he throws a, you know, bomb up and he collapses the tunnel. There was some dodgy work in that. It cut away pretty quick, but it was there. And there were a couple of shots, the weirdest thing in the world to me, where the stars didn't look right. And that got under my skin really bad for some reason.
Yes, that would actually be the only thing that I truly noticed. And I wondered if it was like they were trying to go for the effect that we're focused on the ship coming in, and so that the stars, but in Star Wars, the stars are always clear no matter what you're focused on. So it was just, yeah.
Yeah, and there were a couple of shots where the stars were like, I was like, yeah, okay, this is not right. And but again, that's a nitpicky thing. Absolutely nobody I saw the film with cared. That's the thing, is like we lose focus sometimes, I think, on exactly how particular we can get about things. There were a couple of comps that didn't work right. There were a couple of things that did, but if we're dead honest with ourselves, if we go back to the prequels, there's very much a tradition in Star Wars of good enough is good enough. You go back to the original Return of the Jedi band scene, there's even behind the scenes footage of people fretting about Cy Snoodles talking and Lucas himself saying, it's okay. Just have her mouth, you know, blah, 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 blah. That's fine. That's fine. Let it go that way. And then, of course, when he gets exposed to CG technology, you know, decades later, he's like, oh, no. We're going to redo everything here. But, you know, it's okay for some things to be good enough. Where I really want to heap praise for the effects is the stop motion work is phenomenal. I loved the robot fight. It was terrific. I could tell clearly it was stop motion, but it filled me with joy to see it. And I don't know. I haven't been able to pin anybody down on this, but I'm pretty sure Gatorre was stop motion. And at least scenes of him were stop motion. And I know that the scene of Grogu unwrapping the cure,
that was definitely
stop motion. There's no question in my mind that was stop motion. But it was so beautiful to see it. And to be reminded, especially of the fact of how close Phil Tippett came to doing the dinosaurs for Jurassic Park. And again, there's an alternate timeline where that happened. And how different was the world, sort of thing. But seeing those moments of stop motion in this, there's no reason to do it except to do it because you can. And that in and of itself feels very fun.
Well, and I think part of that is the love of the things that Lucas loved, like Jason and the Argonauts and those kind of things, right? And so, no, I just couldn't agree with you more. I think when it comes to all of that, it was so well done. It was just enjoyable. And part of it, I think, we've just almost lost the love of filmmaking itself. You know, I think that's the thing that Lucas and Spielberg and Scorsese and Ford Coppola brought back to us, and is a love of just the art of filmmaking. It is an art. And so the things that you do to bring that to life, the stories to life, is a part of the art. And it's become such a machine in some ways.
Yeah.
That we forgot to just appreciate the artistic nature of this. And I think, to me, that's the thing that this movie kind of brought back, was the art of filmmaking.
Yeah.
That we are going to appreciate the art of filmmaking. And so, speaking of Martin Scorsese, we do need to talk quickly about just a couple more friends. You know, Sigourney Weaver's in the movie as a supporting role here, and you've got Martin Scorsese playing Hugo, the Ardenian. And I mean, you know, I don't know. What are we going to say about Scorsese? Absolute cinema?
Oh, please. What are we going to say about Scorsese is New York, classic old school New Yorker comes through no matter what you do. And I think that it's not a giant leap to say, well, Jon Favreau worked on, you know, he worked on the Clone Wars with Filoni, but his pathway into live action Star Wars was playing an Ardenian. So is it too far a bridge to cross to say that Martin Scorsese might now make a Star Wars film? I hope so. Ooh. Let's start that rumor.
Let's
Martin Scorsese, Star Wars. Obviously, when he worked on The Irishman, he likes technology. He likes advancing film tech. Yep. Let's get Martin Scorsese. He can do Hugo, a Star Wars story. We can find out how that food stand got built and maybe get a recipe for that delicious-looking sandwich that they created.
Oh, my gosh. If they don't start selling that at Galaxy's Edge, they're fools.
What are they doing? What are we even doing here?
Sandwich? Come on, man.
That looked, I mean, I'm dead serious. Like, it's rare that a sci-fi movie makes something where I'm like, you know, that actually that looks good. I would eat that. Like, I'm on board.
No, I thought he was great. And on top of that, you know, I thought Sigourney Weaver just brought this calm presence. And what I loved is that she wasn't trying to play, you know, the hard-ass colonel, right? She's tough, but she's fair. Like, I love that moment where, you know, Mando has brought back Coin instead of bringing back the hut that would lead them to Coin, right? And at the end of the conversation, she's just like, Mando, good job. You know, and it's just, she just brings this kind of wonderful motherly presence to it that I just really appreciated. And I just, it was fun to see Sigourney Weaver be in this movie. And, you know, one of the things that I've always appreciated throughout the last few years of what Taylor Sheridan has done in his universe, which is to bring all these stars that we knew and give them a way to shine in ways that we hadn't seen before, like making Harrison Ford a cowboy. Who didn't do that like years ago?
Now,
I don't know why.
Now,
right?
To be fair, Jon Favreau was the first to do it with Cowboys and Aliens.
It's true.
So there you go.
So, but I just, Weaver was great. You know, she did everything you needed the role to do. And it was just fun to like have her now in Star Wars. She's a part of the Star Wars family, which is great.
You know, I will say, you know, with the side characters like hers and you know, there's Radha, there's these other characters. This is the stuff where coming out of the showing with my youngest, I thought to myself, why is Star Wars publishing asleep on this? Why am I not getting these stories in book form? I would consume these things like a Burger King Whopper that's tied to The Mandalorian. Like, give me some books, man. Give me some comic books. Give me anything tied to the stuff that I'm seeing in this movie. I will absolutely just consume it like fast food. And I mean, I'm at a loss because had I any sort of sway over at Lucasfilm, I'd be sitting there pitching that. I'd be like, oh, we got all of these cool characters coming up. Okay, well, let's talk about the adventures of this squadron going around and like bringing Geese to the Galaxy, and what's the story about, you know, like working with the Hutts and the crime syndicates? Like, let's get that stuff out there. Like, there's ancillary material to mine here. And I don't know, am I just asleep at the wheel? Am I missing it? Like, is there stuff out there that I haven't seen? I mean, you're more plugged in than I am. Is there anything coming out?
I haven't seen anything in that way.
Is there
a
novelization of this movie?
I don't think so. I haven't seen anything
else.
That blows
my mind.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because that's the type of thing where it's like, oh, okay, well, they'd flesh out some other stuff. Novelizations are supposed to be a big deal, I thought.
Well, and I mean, I think that's where, you know, with the villains that we have, the twins, Lord Janu, Embo, even though he's not necessarily a villain, but he's kind of playing one here because he's against our heroes.
He's who Mando used to be.
Yeah, and that's what I loved about having Embo here. He's the character who's never been confronted with the need to change. He's just stayed the same thing he's always been. We've seen him in the Clone Wars, and he'll just fight for whatever side pays him enough. And I loved that. I thought that juxtaposition was great. But, I mean, you know, I loved also bringing back the twins from the Book of Boba Fett. I thought that was great. And utilizing them as kind of our main archetypal villains here that are in control of the Hutt Enterprise that, you know, Jabba used to have control of. And we saw that in the Book of Boba Fett, right? Where they kind of like acquiesced some of their territory to Boba Fett himself. And yet they're now kind of on the throne of now Hutta, which is really interesting. Of course, now they're dead because they're snake food, but you know.
You know, I got to ask you a question, because with that scene, I talked about it with my kids who saw the movie too, where did you have any pity for them when they got eaten? Because I did, and I attribute that to the fact that the animation was so good. I mean, the CGI, it's still animation, folks. The animation was so good, I believed the fear in their faces. I actually felt sympathy for these villainous characters because I saw their faces and I was like, oh, it's about to be really unpleasant for them. Like I felt, yeah, they're terrible people. They deserve their comeuppance. It's their own fault, all of that stuff. But there's almost like that part of me that I got to know, did you feel any sympathy for them where you're kind of like, oh, that's kind of a crappy way to go? Would have been better if Mando just shot him.
Yeah. I just hope that they're not slowly digested over 1,000 years.
Well, they're still alive when they go in, right?
Yeah.
They gotta be sitting there knowing what's happening.
It's a good question. I don't think I necessarily felt sorry for him, but I did notice what you did, which is just the animation with the characters is really well done. And I think that selling the fear and knowing that there's nothing they can do because of the type of creature they are, they are relatively helpless, right?
Yeah.
And which makes it so fascinating that they are these, you know, criminal crime lords, and how in the world, gosh, I kind of want that story. How in the world did they become that, you know, when they seem to be such helpless creatures, you know? All of that, I think, you know, just I really enjoyed it. And one of the things that, you know, I've seen some people kind of complain about with Star Wars, but I thought they did a great job with here, is that our villains are straight up villains, right? They don't have remorse for their actions, you know. You know, you've got a variety of villains with the twins who clearly don't care who lives and who dies as long as it's not them. You have Lord Janu, who's the type of villain who he'll turn the moment it's beneficial to him. And then you got the other villain, like Embo, where it's like, whoever pays me enough money is the one I work for, you know? And so I thought that that was kind of interesting to have kind of all three represented in this movie. And I thought they did a good job with that. So let's talk just a little bit. We mentioned it, John, but the action of the film, because the movie has so much action. I mean, this truly is an action adventure film, right? In the most classic sense, right? And What did you think of, I mean, from the start where it's basically starts off like a Bond movie, you know, where it's like the first mission that's ending and leading all the way to the very end on Now Hutta?
I think the action is really well handled because it knows when to take a breather. And I know I made the joke earlier that it's action scene, the movie. But to your point, it opens with the action scene and goes into credits. That's another disorienting thing from a Star Wars movie perspective is I have on-screen credits.
Yes.
That's weird. Going to a Star Wars movie and that happens. But then it takes the right amount of breather between each thing. And I think that the nice thing about it is that the action is relentless until it isn't. And the moment where it is not relentless is when Grogu takes his break taking care of the Mandalorian. That's our deep breath before we go into the next sequence. But this movie has a deathmatch, creatures getting loose on a planet, the Imperial thing to open it up with. It has an aerial dogfight. It has a grudge match with three Hutts. It has running through a jungle, Rambo style, fighting droids. It has X-Wing strafing run and actually showing like a flying corps for the Republic looking like a fully functional attack group.
Yep.
Which is crazy and easily handling, you know, these other, like, again, I think that might be something that people react to is that we're used to the overwhelming odds of the Empire. And instead, here the Republic has the upper hand. And again, it's another book that I want written where it's like, okay, they took these Hutts out and I walk out of the theater saying, well, oh my gosh, you just destabilized the entire criminal syndicate network. What next? What happens now? Like, is this what triggers the thing so that the Empire is no longer fully functional? Or is this the thing that gives them the disconnect that lets the First Order rise? Like, that sort of stuff is suddenly playing around in my brain. But again, coming back to the action, I think it's feverish. It's relentless in how much action there is. But the simple fact that it's all, for the most part, clear and never breaks the sense of understanding where I am in a chase scene or in a fight scene or the orientation of things. It never breaks the 180 rule. It always keeps things oriented properly, especially with that battle over Now Hutta at the end. Really easy for the space of things to get a little jumbled. It's not perfect, but it's 90% there, and that's good enough to fully function.
It's not the muddied mess of the Force
Star
Awakens.
Killer Base.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, man, I mentioned this when I was when I entered this section. Like, it starts off like a Bond film, you know, which I thought was great. You know,
including with a skiing moment.
Exactly. I agree with you. Like, the action is so well choreographed for the most part that you truly know where you are and have this understanding of space and everything, which so many movies don't, which really goes to show that, I mean, Favreau is the director here. He understands that stuff. But it comes to all the guys who are working on this that have been doing Star Wars for a long time, and Filoni is one of them, who learned how to edit from George. And has been editing and working with edits of Star Wars things longer than anybody else alive, which is crazy, other than George Lucas, right? And I think that's the thing that really, it just works. The action in the film works, and it's fun and it's vibrant, and I think they just did a really good job with it. And, you know, having seen the movie as many times as I have, I've never gotten bored during the action sequences. I'm always enjoying new little moments from them, which is pretty impressive, you know? And so, and, you know, I think what's crazy about this is that, you know, like this cinematographer has worked on Skeleton Crew and The Mandalorian.
David Klein, right?
Yep, Book of Boba Fett. So, but I thought that part all looked really well done. And I mean, even just the lighting and when it's really bright outside was actually incredibly well done. The editors here, I thought, did a great job with, you know, one of the editors worked on Solo Star Wars Story as well as The Mandalorian. So they know their Star Wars stuff, which is great. And so, yeah, I think the action here was just... It felt like Star Wars action, you know, which is its own thing.
Now, I will give you that definitely on the micro level of the editing, scene by scene, I think it was very well done overall. On the macro level, this is going to be overstating it, but for a reason. I think 2 hours, 12 minutes is too long. I think this movie could have lost... And this is a lot of screen time that I'm talking about here. This movie could have trimmed 10 to 15 minutes, and I would not have missed it. And that's me being, I think, very judicious. There are certain moments where it could have been tightened. And, of course, that bleeds over into the micro-editing stuff. Now, in the micro-editing stuff, it all works in terms of knowing where I am in relation to certain things. But then... You know, there are certain sacrifices you have to make at that level about, well, if you introduce a wipe, I don't need that many cuts of the ship traveling through hyperspace. I can just wipe and I'm there. That's okay. Or I can, you know, put a scene in between. Like I talked about before, having his conversation with Rada be spread over two scenes where he's able to just walk in the first one and then the second one he has to break in. That's something that could be condensed and fixed a bit. And I think that would have served the purpose toward getting Grogu his arc to his arc within the context of the film quicker. I also don't think I would have ended the same way. If anything, I would have ended with the ship going off into hyperspace. I'm not saying taking the shot of Grogu out of him pushing the button. I'm talking about that specific shot doesn't wrap up the story for me visually the way that I would want it to. I would have put in another shot. It's as quasi unsatisfying for me as going to the shot of Broom Boy at the end of The Last Jedi. Where it's like, there were a lot of different shots you could have done here. That's not the one I would have chosen. Maybe that's nitpicky. I don't know. But, all you know, basically, I'm just trying to be fair in my estimation of it because I would have beaten up other franchise movies on these same terms. I think that there's an argument to be made that there are decisions that could have been made that could have made this a quicker tell. And if it's 10, if it's 15 minutes, that gets you still to about 2 hours, but a comfortable 2 hours and tells the story a little bit quicker. And if we're going to be talking about feeling like a Lucasfilm, faster, more intense, just condense it. Just cut it down to the bone. I don't think this was cut to the bone. I think there was still a little fat there.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting. I don't know if I don't think I feel quite as strongly about it as you. I could sense there being some trims here or there and maybe have this down to 205. You know, as Billy Joel said, you know, they would cut it down to 305, but 205 here, you know, is probably good for me. I think I loved one of the things I actually liked about the film was remembering Lucas's ship establishing shots. You know, you think of A New Hope, there's three different shots of the Millennium Falcon coming into Yavin 4 base. And then there's the final descending shot, you know? And so, yeah, I just kind of felt like, I don't know, it's very Star Wars-y to me. So, but I can totally see what your point is. And I don't feel as strongly about it as you do, though.
Sure. The thing is, it's one of those things where I think seeing it more than once in quick succession, sitting there sort of being very, very straightforward with that specific criticism. I think that what surprised me was how well Rada played for me. I didn't expect it to. I didn't expect him to have as big a role in it as he did. I would have additionally given more of an impact to his role. I know that we have to get him away and get him onto Nal Hutta. I probably would have found a different way to get him there. What that is, I don't know. I'm not trying to rewrite the movie. It just felt a little bit clunky, but I don't care about it specifically because the kidnapping from Nevarro to set up Grogu putting on his armor and having that moment where he grows and he goes, that's really cool. I will say that the one thing that made me sad was him going back to Nevarro and rest in peace, Carl Weathers.
Yeah.
Going back to Nevarro and not having a moment with with him just felt weird, made me sad about it. But I'm also curious, but glad that there weren't other Mandalorians interacting with him to be like, hey, welcome home. Like that, that's okay, but it's like, it's not a criticism. It's like, okay, that was a decision sort of thing.
I mean, this is how we bring Cara Dune back is, right. Unfortunately, the High Magistrate has passed away and we need somebody to come in and take the job. And we're going to bring back Marshall Dune to do it. So anyway, got to ask you about the music. Obviously, Star Wars and music go hand in hand because of John Williams. And we've had other people do Star Wars films now.
God bless you, John Powell.
And John Powell and Michael Giacchino and, of course, Kevin Kiner. And so how does Ludwig Göransson do? He's already done the Mandalorian series, most of it anyway. How does he do with his feature film debut for Star Wars?
Oh, I think that's one of the things where I could understand certain fans sort of beating up on it because the score does feel like the show appropriately, but it's a Star Wars movie that doesn't have that bombast to it. There's no big fanfare at the beginning. Now, Solo didn't have it, neither did Rogue One, but there's no big fanfare moment that you're used to having in a Star Wars movie. But in exchange, I got, I'm always going to call the planet Shakira. I can't help it. You have that establishing music. Instead of Hips Don't Lie, what would it be? Would it be like your...
I don't know.
Your ecliptic your don't, equator lie?
Don't lie.
Yeah, your, yeah. Your equator don't lie, your ecliptic don't lie, whatever. but additionally, and I've gone on record with this, no pun intended, I want a 12-inch mix of Rada's music because... a minute and a half isn't enough for me on the soundtrack. I want a nice, like, long mix of that, like a good 5-6 minute mix of that music because that was fantastic. The music's great. Is there anything that is groundbreaking? No. This is not Göransson working on Oppenheimer. This is Göransson saying, oh, yeah, I've done most of this before. I'm going to pull it forward and expand it. And so it's very good for what he's doing.
I think that the beauty of the score is You know, and this is the fun part about this is like I listened to it before the film. I always do this for the most part. But then watching the way some of those scenes actually play in the film, like at the beginning where there's the alarm going off that's in the soundtrack.
Yeah.
But it's also a part of the film and how beautifully that plays. And, you know, I thought that Goranson did a fantastic job. I think especially the thing that really stands out to me and every time that I've seen the movie, the music utilized for Grogu specifically is wonderful. And I think that it has such a wonderful reminder of the Force theme and Yoda's music without being that. Right. But it just it has those kind of hallmarks, but a younger version of that. And I love it. I think the score works like gangbusters. So really well done. Lastly, John, something that as we were talking about what we want to talk about and, you know, you're not always somebody to add something to the outline, which you never pay attention to anyway.
No,
you
I
wanted
never
to talk about critics versus audience because, you know, yeah. Critics have a 62% rating right now on Rotten Tomatoes, whereas the popcorn meter for fans is at 98%. Or if we wanted to take the cinema score, which is an A-, which is one of the best of, in fact, that's the best of the Disney era.
I think that there is a divide. I mean, obviously between critics and fans. Or movie viewers, I would point to another movie that came out this year that was a quote unquote surprise hit, which is Michael, which I know people who have seen it who said they loved it. They want me to go see it. And I'm like, really? Because the critics absolutely curb stomped that movie, but the audiences loved it. And it's become a big hit. In this context specifically, what's gotten under my skin yet again is that the critic reaction is used as a cudgel to paint the image that the only people who are saying they like this online are fans who are so blind that they can't see past themselves. They can't understand that they don't really like it. Like it's a joke that I have that for some reason some people still don't get the joke, but somebody will say, oh, hey, I really like that. And I'll look at them and I'll say, no, you didn't. And it's a gag because I don't really care. But it's that sort of thing that we've gone into. Additionally, I think the critics are existing in a state of they're now reviewing so many things that there's certain aspects of their perspective that are getting deadened because they're not able to experience as just a normal audience anymore. And I think, unfortunately, that there are certain people who look at the critical reaction and consider it as permission to feel one way or another and then pile on people for their own opinion about it. I wish everybody would take critical reaction and box office. Again, I don't make a dime on this. Neither do you. The hell do I care what the box office is? It doesn't matter. And all of this different stuff that's going on out there where people are like, oh, this is this opening in the Disney era. Oh, it used to be that Star Wars made a blah, 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 blah. Who cares? How many movies have you seen that weren't, you know, giant hits? Tron Legacy technically was a money loser and killed the franchise, quote unquote. And then, thanks, we got a Jared Leto movie decades later that sucked. But seriously, like, why do we as a fan community come together and use critical reaction and box office as some way to argue about a movie? Who the hell, again, like Peter Griffin says, who the hell cares? It doesn't matter. All that matters is the product. Oh God, people come after me for that. All that matters is what was produced. The film. How do you feel about it? Did you like it? Did you not? Why? Either way. Leave the rest of it aside. Let's stop talking about that crap.
I misspoke. It wasn't the best cinema score. It's a good cinema score for Star Wars movies. There have been some in the Disney era that are better. But anyway, I agree with you. And I think the thing that I was actually, and I'm really, really disappointed in, I am sick and tired of the trades seeking to destroy films before they even come out.
Yeah.
Because of the bad press that they give them, in the sense of like, oh, this movie is tracking for this, and oh, we've heard complaints about this, and it's just like they talk about all these things before the public, before the audience actually gets to see it, and it can create in their minds this thing that maybe it causes people to not go check out the movie for themselves. And I think, you know, look, there are certain movies I think that you could do that with. I mean, look, nobody thinks Showgirls is this the gem of, and I didn't have to see it to know that it was going to suck, right? That it wasn't going to be a good movie, right? But for the most part, by and large, you should just go to check out a movie and see what you think of it. You know, and I have just watched the trades with this movie specifically spend so much time talking bad about everything around the movie, the optics, the marketing, tracking for the film, and all this stuff that, like you were saying, doesn't matter. What matters is what people think about it, which, as we're sitting right now, as we're recording on a Sunday night, before Memorial Day, the movie is tracking higher than they thought it was going to. And why? Because the audience is liking it and apparently is telling their friends, hey, you should go see this movie. And, you know, I think one of the things that we're kind of learning in many ways throughout this process, and I think this year is actually a benchmark for that, for the movie-going audience. We're seeing theaters do better business. We're seeing Hollywood make more money because of it, because people are going to films that critics don't like, and yet they're going back over and over again to see these movies, and they're making more money than they thought they were going to make. I think that what we're seeing is that word of mouth means more than social media these days, because people have realized that social media isn't real life. It is bots and people that have been bought by studios telling you what to think.
And algorithms being thrown in your face. I mean,
exactly.
I'll go back to your point, and also tying into an earlier point about this being a relatively safe release. It's okay if it's not groundbreaking, if it just does what it's supposed to do in terms of box office, which is make its money back plus some. Because of the fact that nobody remembers to this point that Iron Lung by online guy Markiplier, I saw that with my daughter. Nobody remembers it existed. It did really well for what it was, made a profit. It was a good movie. Hokum, I saw that. It's an Adam Scott movie. Nobody even remembers that came out, and that was, you know, like a month ago or something like that. I really enjoyed it. I thought it was great. Told everybody to go see it. Yeah, did it work? Whatever. But, you know, tying into your point, it really is word of mouth now. I think people actually have disconnected overall, and with good reason, to just sort of wait to hear from somebody they know, they actually know, about a movie, because they realize they've been played by all of this stuff. And to your point about the trades, It's a mean girl's world, man.
Yeah.
With Hollywood Reporter and Variety and Deadline. It's all just like, oh, look at this. Oh, this is the terrible thing. And people pick up on that, and they're like, oh, look at this box office opening for Star Wars in the Disney era. What? Again, that doesn't tell me whether the movie's any good. It just tells me whether it found an audience or not. And you know, Megalopolis is one of the greatest disasters in box office cinema in terms of receipts. But there are people out there that like it. You going to beat them up for it? Are you? Like, no. Like, I don't know. I know it's sort of like a, feels a little bit like old man, you know, yells at clouds sort of moment. But, you know, that's where I am with it.
Yeah. No, I that's well said, man. And I think that leads us to just what we're going to rate Star Wars, The Mandalorian, and Grogu.
Oh, wow. You want me to go first?
Okay. Yes, sir. Well, wait, all right. Do I talk first? You talk first?
Yeah. Oh, please. No. God, jeez. Somebody edit that line out of the movie already, please. And also fix the opening note of the fanfare, please. Anyway, this is a movie that I wind up rating generously, and I recognize I'm rating generously. I'm coming in at a 4. If I'm in a grumpy mood, it could go as low as a 3 if I'm grumpy. But what I recognize is this is a movie that is committed to just being fun and not being monumental, as it were. And from a technical perspective, with the exception of the editing things that I sort of beat up on a bit, from a technical perspective, seeing Phil Tippett's studio at work is a joy. Seeing some of the stuff that they pulled off with the CG is a joy. The inconsistency stuff, again, that's always been an issue, but in this era of shipping out to the, you know, the overseas lab while everybody else sleeps over in the US and stuff like that, I wish everybody just kept everything in-house and just kept it here, and so that they could coordinate better. So I wind up landing with a 4 for this overall because I do enjoy it. I think it's fun. I will watch it again when it's, you know, when it's released. I'll buy it on home release if they release it on home release. I hope they release it on home release. And I really dug the soundtrack and all of that type of stuff. So this is a 4 for me. What about you?
I'm right there with you. This is a 4 for me. I think it's just a solid 4 in the sense that it's never going to go any higher. And it's just a fun movie. And I think, you know, one of the things that I really appreciate about this film is that a lot like Solo, it just had me kind of enjoying and grinning from ear to ear while I was watching it. And is this even on my list of Star Wars things ranked as high as Solo? No. Like, you know, this is like mid-tier. But that's not, it has no reflection on whether I really enjoyed it and had a great time at the theater and was just so incredibly happy. As a friend of mine said to me, texted me today, I'm so happy to love a Star Wars movie in the theater again. And if anything comes of this, if it just helps people love Star Wars in the theater again, man, it's done its job. And I'm so glad that it happened. And I can't wait to see what comes out next. You know, this gives me real hope for the fact that, you know, now that Dave Filoni is in charge of the studio, that hopefully we can move forward with creating films in the saga that feel very Star Warsy, tell a great story, and help us to have all sorts of experiences. You know, Episode 3 is not a fun film. You know, it's a very heartfelt, gut-wrenching film, but I still love it. You know, we need Star Wars movies, I think, of all different shapes and sizes. I think, you know, I love Solo. You love Solo.
Oh, do I ever.
You know, I love Rogue One. You think Rogue One's okay. You know,
hold on. Let's not open up that argument
all
again.
But what my point in saying this is that all of these are different types of films. You know, Empire Strikes Back is different than Return of the Jedi. Episode 1 is different than Episode 2. You know, like, the point is to have some differentiation between these films, and I think this is just another example of that, and I'm excited. You know, Maul isn't this. Maul Shadow Lord, completely different type of story than this. Andor isn't this. You know, that's fine. It's great. And I just, my prayer is, honestly, I love Star Wars in the theater, and I love being able to go to Star Wars in the theater. I love that people were able to bring their kids to their first Star Wars movie in the theater, and it happened to be this one. because I had so many kids in my theaters just like squeeing with joy at the silly things that, you know, Grogu is doing. And man, that just warmed my heart. The same way you watching this with your kid and her experience, your youngest, right? Your youngest Padawan, how she felt about this movie, I know made you feel things you didn't know you were going to feel about the film, just because there's something about that, and I love it. And so, man, what a great episode, John. And I just, can you imagine, like, can you think at the beginning of the year, man, we're going to have back-to-back things come out for Star Wars that we're just going to have so much fun talking about? What a joy, man.
Absolute joy. I just wish Ahsoka was coming out this year too, but that's
same.
Okay. That's okay. I can wait till early 2027.
Oh,
that's okay.
Man.
That's okay. I can do that. Yeah, it's going to be a little bit of a drought from here on out, isn't it?
Maybe we could get some home releases of things that haven't come out yet. You know, like we've got Book of Boba Fett and Skeleton Crew.
That'd be nice.
You know, that type of stuff that hasn't come out in home release. So maybe do that for us. And that can, you know, assuage our, you know, sad hearts now knowing that we'll have to wait till 2027 for, you know, something else Star Wars.
Just give me some new audio dramas. Huh?
That too.
Huh?
There you go.
Maybe
some of the books will be good. Anyway, John, if people wanted to catch up with you, of course, talk more Mando and Grogu or Maul Shadow Lord or anything else, where would they find you?
Well, you can find me online as Kessel Junkie over on Letterboxd and Goodreads. That's where I have the most amount of fun. I get in the least amount of trouble. You can, of course, find me over on the Nerd Party Network, where I'm co-hosting two shows. One of them is called House Lights, where I talk about films with Darren Moser and Tristan Riddell. We have a blast with that one. It's a lot of fun. And of course, I'm on Aggressive Negotiations over on the Nerd Party, which is a very long-running Star Wars podcast, which we're always welcoming new family into the fold. We would love to adopt you into the Aggressive Negotiations family. And I co-host that with you, one Mr. Matthew Rushing.
Well, I have a blast doing that, and I hope people will check it out because it really is fun. I mean, the fact that we've been talking Star Wars for over 10 years now together is a joy.
And we still have things to talk about. How crazy is that?
That is awesome. So, of course, you can find me all over social media under the name MattRushing02 here on the network outside of the 602 Club. You can find me talking a lot of great Star Trek talk with my good friend Chris Jones and over on the TFM network. And over on the Nerd Party Network, outside of Aggressive Negotiations, doing Owl Post, talking about every single chapter of the Harry Potter series, one chapter at a time. But thanks so much for joining us. And John, you know what? Guess what? They're serving at the Jedi Temple tonight. Flat meat, flatbread sandwiches. I think it's time to close these negotiations.
Master Rushing, negotiations are closed, and y'all come back now, you hear?